Hey everybody, Nate here. Before the show, I just wanted to take a minute to talk about our sponsor, the Snack Nanny. The Snack Nanny is the latest, greatest spill-proof bowl. It's the first snack bowl for kids with a self-closing door. The Snack Nanny allows kids to snack freely without overeating, keeps kids entertained, and prevents them from creating a mess for mom and dad to clean up. Kids and parents love the Snack Nanny. It's easy to use, easy to clean, and includes portion control features that only the Snack Nanny offers. To order, go to www.snacknanny.com. or order from Amazon. Remember, you support our sponsors and they support us. Thanks, and Nihei Debiru. Hi everyone, and welcome back to Chop Talk. I'm your host, Nate England. If you listen to the show on iTunes, please write a review and give us a 5-star rating. Also, don't forget to like the show on Facebook. It's hard to believe, but we have already been doing the show for 6 months. With so many great guests from 3 continents and across the U.S., I wanted a chance to highlight some of the best moments and stories from Chop Talk. So I asked the fans of the show for their favorite Chop Talk moments, and a few jumped out. Randy Alley, a guest on episodes 6, 7, and 8, was a big fan favorite, primarily because he has had such an interesting life outside of the martial arts. But the stories that everyone seemed to enjoy the most were of his days as a professional skydiver. Chop Talk's number one fan, Barbara Craig from Washington, Illinois, wrote, "Nathan, I enjoy all of your interviews. The one with Randy was good. I really liked the part of him being a parachute rigger. It was nice to hear about how he got started in the martial arts and the rough go he had of it sometimes. Also, it was interesting to hear how it helped him get where he is today, and how Randy made a better person of himself through doing martial arts. It's the same with the others also. This is the one thing I have found about all the people you interviewed, their determination to advance in it. There's a great bond that all of you make with each other. No matter what it takes or how much it costs, they are determined to do it. It is really interesting to hear how and why these guys, especially Randy, decided that's what they wanted to do to better themselves, and how they found the right people to help them." In this clip, Randy talks about how he prevented a potential homicide while packing a parachute.
I guess I held a lot of ratings. I was a static line jump master, and I was a basic instructional course director. I taught people how to be jump masters and instructors. Mm-hmm. I was a static line instructor, and I was a parachute rigger. I still am a parachute rigger. And I've been a safety and training advisor for the United States Parachute Association. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, I've saved my own life a couple times and several others. And it's funny to see how people react. You know, some mm-hmm. of them come back and they're wet themselves and they said, "Your parachute worked, you know, you saved my life," and you got a bottle of whiskey in their hand, you know, and mm-hmm. then it's kind of fun. You know, this one young lady come to me and she wanted a reserve repack. I says, "Okay." And I said, "Well, open it up." She's, "What do you mean?" I says, "Well, it's going to open anyway. You might as well practice opening it. See what it's like. Mm-hmm. Pull your cutaway handle and pull the reserve handle." She pulled the cutaway handle and she pulled and pulled and pulled and pulled and couldn't get the reserve handle to move.
Wow. So this is in the air?
No, this is on the ground.
On the ground, okay.
This was in my living room.
Oh, okay.
And she's sitting there jerking on a handle, and I said, "You might as well stop, you're dead." I says, "If you're not strong enough to pull that handle, you're not going to get your reserve out, and you're going to hit the ground." Mm. So I put a scale on it. Well, a reserve handle is supposed to have like maybe 12 to 15 pounds of pressure, if I remember right, at the mm-hmm. very most. And that one had 60.
Wow.
And it took everything I had to pull it. To get the 60-pound rating on it.
Yeah.
And so I got to looking inside and started inspecting. I says, "Who packed this reserve for you?" And she says, "My boyfriend." I says, "Really?" I says, "He's still your boyfriend?" And she says, "No, we broke up a while back." I says, "Really?" And I said, "That's a good thing. How many jumps you get on this?" She says, "Well, about 100. And I says, "Well, you were lucky 100 times that you packed real well." And she looked at me, she says, "What do you mean?" I said, couldn't pull the handle. If your main hadn't opened, you were going to die.
Wow.
And so when I got the rig open, I looked at it, and the steering toggles weren't even tied onto the steering lines on the reserve parachute.
So even if it had opened,
she would have been able to steer it.
Just wherever the wind blew her.
Yep.
Wow.
And
so that was sounds deliberate. Yeah.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
I called the master rigger that had trained me and gave him the information, and he turned the guy into the FAA, and he lost his rigger's license. They come and they wanted to see my records. I had pictures of everything, and they took his license.
Wow, they booted him. Well, yeah.
My interview in episodes 4 and 5 with South African businessman and martial artist Peter Benson was one of my personal favorites. This clip was suggested by my good buddy Chris Gavin from East Peoria, Illinois. In this clip, Peter talks about sneaking across an African border crossing in the middle of a war.
And I was in this DRC where the current president, Kabila, of the DRC, his father, also Kabila, ousted this Sese Seko.
Okay.
And I was in this little town called Lubumbashi. Now, Central Africans, on average, their average height is about 5'6", 5'7".
All right.
Is their average height.
We're getting into pygmy territory.
Correct. At six... average height. And very... their skin is a darker hue of black, what we call black.
Okay.
It's fundamentally brown, really.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a dark, it was a very dark skin hue that they've got. So now at a 6'3" white, you tended to stand out like a lamppost wherever you went.
Right.
Now, I was standing in this crowd in Lubumbashi. Now, as the soldiers were coming in, Kabila's, the current president's father.
Mm-hmm.
And the next minute I felt this cold metal in my left ear. Every now and then I can still feel the cold metal, you know. And I turned to see, and was one very drunk or stone soldier with an Uzi stuck right in my ear. Demanding all sorts of things. Now, you know, if I was not trained, I think I would have just shat myself, wet my pants, and potentially died in the shithole called Lubumbashi.
Oh, and I would probably have never known what happened to him.
Correct. But because of my martial art training, and it is only nanoseconds if you're looking at it from the outside, but when you're in these conflicts, it seems like...
It slows down.
Correct. It seems like... And the martial art gave me, and does give me, longer minutes, longer seconds.
Mm-hmm.
Because within those nanoseconds that I reacted, I'd looked, I'd worked out that he was out of his tree. Okay. That the safety catch on the Uzi was still in a locked position.
Mm.
So I was knowing and seeing those things instantaneously.
Been in the army also, yeah. So, you know, we did army military service.
It was compulsory.
Yes, you were pulled into that whether you liked it or not. So I was able to deflect the Uzi out, disarm him, put his butt onto the ground, and then for me to duck as quickly as possible. Because I'm the lone 6 foot white. Now,
and if anyone's coming to someone's aid, they're coming to his,
correct.
Not yours.
No, not mine. And because of the martial art training, it wasn't like a big
issue.
Conflag.
Mm-hmm.
I was able to do it relatively quietly and very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
So he was down and out, cold, gone. By the time I reckon that anybody noticed this drunk soldier on the floor, I was a good 3 kilometers away from the site. I was gone. Now, I was now heading for the border, which is the Zambian border and Ndola. So now I'm in a hired car, an Avis hired car, going through the jungles, going down towards Ndola. As I come up to the border and I see the armies, both armies, the Zambian army and this DRC army, all over this border post.
Okay.
Lots. I now abandon this Avis hired car in a village near the border post. Now, when we talk about villages, not talking about Western villages,
okay.
Your minds. You're talking about huts, thatch huts, mud walls, chickens, goats.
What I thought I was going to see when I came to Johannesburg.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, okay.
Exactly. So that's all you saw, but there were army personnel all the way around here. So I'm thinking, so now I abandoned a white Volkswagen Jetta in the middle of this brown, dirty, desolate little town. So that must itself stood out like a sore.
Even your car was white.
Even a car was white. I was in a suit because I was up there in business. Then I decided I was actually going to crash the border. Now, what sane person sits there and thinks they're going to go and crash a border post with two armies on high alert? But because of both my martial art training as well as my army training, it was an obstacle that had to be tackled, and not, I couldn't avoid it. It wasn't something I could walk away from.
Right.
Because now I was sandwiched between Lubumbashi, big revolution, army, guns, everything else, and this border post and so-called freedom in Zambia.
You had to do something. You didn't know what. You had to figure out what.
Whoever thought getting into Zambia would be freedom? I mean, and that's the relativity in Africa, because Zambia is not much better. But I then dashed through the little village, snuck up behind, waited an opportunity, shot across, jumped over the barrier on the Zambian side, physically grabbed the passport entry stamp from the Zambian official and stamped my own passport. And then said to them, they can do what they like with me, I'm now officially in Zambia.
Looking for a way to gain an edge on the competition? Want to give your body some much-needed relief and relaxation? Try Medical Resort ATAC, Okinawa's specialist in sports therapy and wellness care. ATAC offers customizable massage therapy. Try their oxygen chamber for increased metabolism and faster recovery from injuries. Or take their stretching course to improve flexibility. ATAC is used by professional athletes from the Ryukyu Golden Kings, FC Ryukyu, and Ryukyu Corazon. Stop into their center Monday through Saturday at 12830 Oroku in Naha City, Okinawa. Call 098-859-1890 or visit them on the web at www.sanso-atac.com. That's www.sanso-atac.com. We're going to stay in South Africa for the next clip. Imtiaz Abdullah, head of the International Kimbu Kai Karate Kabuto Organization based in Johannesburg, was guest along with Miwa Kanazawa on episode 22. Sensei Abdullah worked tirelessly for more than 20 years to get karate in the Olympics. In this clip, suggested by Richard Garrett from Nashville, Sensei Abdullah expresses his frustration with the Japanese officials on the Olympic Committee.
I guess because he won the world championship 5 times, you know, he thinks... But one thing I'm glad about, that he's now the chairman of the technical commission. So at least some Okinawan karate is coming back into the World Karate Federation, you know. He has a big following internationally. I mean, I'm talking South America, Spain, Portugal, Italy. Very big following. And the one thing I don't like about him, he'd like to be treated as a cult. Everybody must, you know, bow at him and they must look after him, you know, like as if he's the king. The first time I met with him, I was in the World Karate Federation. I know he was this very boisterous. I said to him, hey, listen, you may be whoever you are, but the minute you take off your gi and you put your shirt on, you Sakamoto, finish. Simple. He didn't like what I said, you know, so... Yeah. Because relatively, he competed as Japan, one country, out of all their countries. So you can't, he can't be wanting to want, celebrity status, you know?
Right.
And Hayashi Sensei was very close to me, and he started laughing. So I said, why are you laughing? He says, you're the first guy to tell him this.
That's a little unusual. Most Okinawans I've met are much more laid back about that thing.
No, but he's Japanese.
Okay.
His mentality is Japanese. That's his issue.
Maybe Taka Miyake is another other guy who has this.
That's another guy I had a problem with, huh? You know, in 1993, I went and did a demonstration at the OHU championship. They asked me to do a demonstration. Okay, I did Seiso Shinkata. And after the thing, you know, all the masters were there, so they took a group photograph. And Tomoyoshi Sensei, is it?
Yeah.
He called me. He said, no, Mr. Abdullah, why don't you come and take the photograph with us? Yeah. This guy is, no, no. I looked at him and said, who the hell is this guy? I didn't know who he was. Who the hell is this guy? So he says to me, no, you're not at our level. Not something like that. I said, I never said I was at your level. I was asked to come here. Then Tomoyoshi Sensei said, then don't worry about him. You come to sit.
Richard Awad's interview from episodes 10 and 11 was a favorite for people who know Rec personally and the troubles he's been dealing with over the last few months. Ezra Scott, our guest on last week's show, recommended this clip from the interview, as Richard talks about dealing with someone causing problems at his bar in his own unique way.
Now, this was, oh, matter of fact, did you have this on the other day when I told the story, Jim Simmons was telling about the guy choked out?
I don't think so.
Okay, this is kind of funny story. I'm at the bar, I'm running it, this is about 97, and before I broke my back, it's in about 6 o'clock before we're going to get busy for the evening, and I got my girlfriend with me, and we're just having a little fun before the evening begins, and this drunk guy comes in, and he's sitting there, and the whole bar is empty, I'm getting it ready, you know, I've been talking to her, I'm going to send her home, and
this is early in the night.
Yeah, like 6 o'clock, and I go in the back to do something. I come back, and he's sitting in my seat next to my girl, talking to him, and talking to her. And I go into the back. And I've got a little short sword, but what's the short one's called?
Wakizashi, tanto.
Not a tanto. Not this big. The middle, the in between.
Well, I think wakizashi.
Okay, yeah, that's about how big it was. And I put it in my thing, and I went up to him real nice. Like, he was terribly drunk, and he didn't look very tough at all. I mean, I wasn't gonna hurt him anyway, and. Not even to impress my girlfriend, and
right.
She hadn't seen me hit many people or anything at this time. She has since. Anyway, I go up to her. I said, "That's my seat, and that's my girl, and she doesn't want you talking to her." And he goes, "Well, I'll see your name on it." And I just kind of laughed, and I said, "Now I'm going to step out here, and I guarantee within 30 seconds you're going to move." And I stepped back a little bit and pulled my real big, you know, like, and, I mean, 10 feet away. And I come charging him. Sure enough, he jumped up, moved out away from it. And I put my sword away, and I said, "Well, there you go. I said you're going to move now. Do you want another drink? I'll get you a beer." "No, I'm going to whip your ass." Said, "Oh, no. Come on, man."
He's gonna get his revenge on you.
Yeah, I said, "Look."
Did you still have the sword when he told you he's gonna whip your ass?
I said, "Look, you don't see I got a sword here. I was just being funny." Anyway, Dad, I said, "You're just drunk now. Come on." And I take the sword and put it up on the bar. And I step back a little bit. The guy kind of attacks me with it. It wasn't even a valid attack. I can't describe it. You know, when I'm kind
he's
of
lunged at you,
kind of like wiggly hand lunge.
Okay.
You know. And I said, I knew exactly what I was going to do. I was really giving Jim Simmons a lesson. I should have said before, I said, "Jim, now I'm going to show you this lapel choke." And I already seen his collar, and I just grabbed a hold of him real quick and pulled it up. And I mean, the guy was just immediately went into shock. It looked like I had electric hands or something. You know, and he's there, he had never fought or nothing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I actually felt sorry for him. And he's
but you weren't going to let him go.
Well, no. He was flailing his hands, and all I had to do was stretch him out a little bit.
Right.
And then I said, "Well, this is the best part." I said, "Sir, you're now going to start getting sleepy a little bit. You'll be okay. You won't bleed. You won't, that's the only sleepy. Yeah, don't worry. I know what I'm doing. Jim, you watching this?" And Jim and my chef, oh, God, I can't remember his name now. Boy, he was, damn, I loved him. He can really cook. Anyway, I took him all the way and laid him real nice, boom, on the floor. And I said, "You guys are going to have to throw him out now, you know." So they took him outside and told him he had to leave. And he was real drunk. I said, "You got to watch him now. Don't let him go in the street." And so they said, "Well, we got rid of him." And the next thing I knew, anytime you do something like that, old Master Tree has taught us this. You knock somebody out in the bar or anything, leave. It's my bar, I couldn't leave. Mm-hmm. So I told him, I said, take this sword and hide in the back. You know? And sure enough, here this guy comes in drunk. That's the guy! I said, what is it? I said, are you back? And the cop says, this guy said he was attacked by somebody with three or four guys with all kinds of weapons. I said, you can see he's drunk. I said, we had to tell him to leave. I said, look, there ain't no, we're not even really getting customers in here or not. At that time, my bartender said, he had a little plastic cocktail sword.
Sure.
That you put your olives on. And he said, I threatened him with this one. And I said, oh. The cop laughed and said, I said, look, he just needs to go home. I didn't have no problem with him. He just got too drunk too early. Okay, that's what we thought it was. Thanks. And he hustled the guy out. And at that time, I think he actually took the guy home. Hmm. Sometimes he used to do that because he wasn't driving.
Not anymore.
Yeah, I know.
You go to jail.
He wasn't driving. I said, no, I don't want to put charges on him. You don't want to do that with your customers. Mm. You know. And I said, he can even come back sometimes if he likes. I mean, I'm a businessman. I'm trying to build this up.
Everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks. Remember, if you have an upcoming seminar, tournament, or other martial arts event, let us know, and we'd be happy to announce it on the program. And now, back to the show. Karate legend James McClain joined the show for episodes 14 and 15 during my road trip to Nashville. In this clip, suggested by Satoko Akema from Naha, Okinawa, he tells a story about hitchhiking from Peoria to Phoenix to train with Grandmaster Trias for the first time.
Doug Rose told Master Kiffel that he'd heard of a man in Arizona by the name of Master Trias, and that he was, you know, he was a state trooper at the time. Mm. And just straight as an arrow and all that, and to, of course, later days he wasn't straight as an arrow.
Later the arrow started wobbling a little bit?
Yeah. Master Kiffel, he's talking on the phone, and Master Kiffel couldn't get away, and so he sent me out there.
Okay.
Well, you were like about 17 or 18 at this point?
Yeah, he sent me to
just to kind of investigate
to
things.
Phoenix, see, so I hitchhiked to Phoenix.
Okay. You hitchhiked?
Well, yeah.
Oh, well, okay. Well, it was the 60s, I guess.
Everybody
hitchhiked.
That's the way it was.
That's the way it was.
Yeah, you could get a ride. Well, right now, you couldn't borrow. I mean, it'd be dangerous.
Right.
Yeah. It is really dangerous.
People don't trust
a hitchhiker. You don't know.
And you get picked up.
And, of course, you don't know who you're riding with either. So he sent me to Phoenix. So I had to go to Phoenix and represent Master Kevill and all that, and association. And Master Trias taught me Kung Fu Show personally.
Wow. Yeah.
The only thing he didn't do was the jump. He just kind of stepped back.
Okay.
He was a big old, he was 240 then.
Yeah. But he made you do the jump, right?
Oh, Lord, yeah. But I stayed there, I didn't leave the dojo for 12 days. And I'd go out with him to eat and come back, that was it. Boy, fast, things changed, God.
Yeah, so he was very strict.
Oh, Lord.
As far as what was going on, anything that was going on in the dojo and
oh, yeah, absolutely, in them days.
And you had some sort of incident with him with that where, like, you had a friend showed a girl some pictures just in like the front room of the dojo.
Oh yeah, I went up to this little cocktail bar up there, and brought this girl back down to the dojo, and it was this, I didn't take her, had a little front there, you know, had a couple of seats, pictures all over her, and I, and they had this guy named Ross Riggins.
Okay, Ross Riggins.
Ross Riggins, yeah. He lived at yoga. He lived at the yoga, and then Master Trius picked him up on the beach. And he was under medication. Master Trius took care of all his medication and all that kind of stuff. And so Riggins, Ross Riggins, he'd tell Master Trius everything that went on. And so I brought a couple of my two ladies, and I brought them down and just showing them the pictures and all that. Mm-hmm. So he called Master Trius up. Master Trius up, told him, and Master Trius come back. And he was real strict then. And he called me in the office there, and he says, "What's this I hear about you? You had some women in here." And I said, I told him what it was. And he said, "Well, I probably already just like, I'm gonna call your sensei up, talk to him about this. I'll get back to you."
That probably.
Well, I was just.
Because you were just a kid at the time. And you're gonna call the sensei. Yeah.
I didn't do it to be disrespectful or anything. Just
right.
So that's how it all got started.
So did he? Did he forgive you for the women? Did he tell you to start hitchhiking the other way?
No, he just said, "Don't let that ever happen again."
Okay.
He's real strict.
So then you had, so you learned Kankusho there in Phoenix, and you took it back to Peoria.
Yeah, and then I had to forget it.
You had to forget it?
Yeah.
How's that?
Because he wasn't high enough rank to know it.
He
wasn't learning it for him to learn it. He was learning it for him to take it back up there and show it to Master Kep.
Okay. So you took it back to Peoria.
Imagine what that'd be like.
Showed it to Mr. Kep.
Yeah, that was
supposed to do it anymore.
That was the hardest thing I ever done in my life.
Yeah.
It just embarrassed me to do that, you know.
To teach your teacher the kata.
Yeah.
Well, how did he take that?
Well, pretty good.
Okay. And he told you to forget it?
Yeah, it's kind of hard to forget stuff.
So you'd work it in one of those late night sessions?
Right? No, Master Kepel didn't. He said, work it. That's what he told me.
Yeah. Well, you're the guy who brought it back and learned it, and if it wasn't for you, none of them would have it.
And at that time, I mean, you were training so much, it didn't really take a very long time for you to become a black belt either, because you were training so many hours per day.
I trained all the time.
Yeah. I remember you told me that
I trained a couple hours.
A lot of people talk about training. Well, I've been training in martial arts for this many years. And Mr. McClain would ask him, "Well, how many hours have you actually trained?"
That's
you say you've been going in a dojo for like 10 years or something, but how many hours have you really trained?
Is that
really
an hour, a couple hours a week?
Yeah, because I mean, and a lot of people, they'll say that. You know, I've been training karate for this long or whatever. Well, they really only train like 3 hours a week or something like that, where Mr. McClain, he might have trained 40 or 50 hours in a week for a year. Imagine how good you'd be.
It's like a full-time job.
That's really all I thought about.
Just karate training, martial arts.
Yeah. You know, I found something I could belong to, because my life was really kind of messed up. I don't know what else I'd be doing right now.
On a road trip to Wisconsin, I stopped in Authentic Ancient Arts for a workout and an interview with Sensei Neil Stoltzmark for episodes 20 and 21. This has turned out to be a real fan favorite, and there are quite a few great moments from the show. Chris Gavin from East Peoria, Illinois, was a big fan of the Black Belt Challenge matches, and Neil Stinson from Nashville really liked the discussion of village kata. So here are clips of both.
What was it? What would you call it? The Black Belt Challenge matches?
Yeah.
What is that? Is this something they called it in a tournament, or were you guys calling each other out?
No, they just called it a Black Belt Challenge, but they were fought in the ring, in a boxing ring.
Okay.
And it was kind of in the middle of kickboxing, American kickboxing and the point karate tournaments, mm-hmm. because you could hit the guy as hard as you wanted, but you still had the 4-ounce gloves. So.
Okay.
But it was also they call points, so it wasn't a continuous thing. But they were exciting matches. Mm-hmm. People used to love to watch those. They went over a lot of times. They went over better than kickboxing. as far as the audience.
Because of the technique or the speed of it?
Yeah,
or
the speed, the technique. People can relate to it because they can see, you know, when a point is called, they understand, you know, mm-hmm. oh, okay, I get it. He hit him in the head or he kicked him in the face, you know, mm-hmm. rather than the continuous, you know, with the boxing kick.
Because it's really hard to tell what's going on with the continuous because you got the judges in the corner with yep. with the little tickers yep. and nobody knows until the end.
Until the end, right.
So were they knockout matches or was it just
some
just
were,
points?
Some were. Okay. Some were knockouts and some were not. Sometimes if you knock the guy out, you lost 3 points.
Okay.
Yeah. And if the guy couldn't continue, then you get disqualified. But there was others where if you knocked him out, you won.
Okay.
I had a few of those that I did well at.
So. Oh, that's good. And you got to remember which rule you're fighting yeah. under in the middle. I guess if you get hit too hard, you might switch rules in the middle.
Yeah. Always know the rules before you go.
you know, when you look at the Kabuto names, a lot of the names of the katas are names of cities or islands or things that are farther out, that are a little more rural, as yep. opposed to a lot of karate names are maybe named after a Chinese person who came over and taught, like Kusanku, Wanshu, something like that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, was it that the Kabuto was much more rural and these people are going out and picking one, this guy visited this island and learned their tonfa kata and then came back?
Yeah, I think that that's really accurate, because they always talk about village kata. Mm. And people would hear about this village kata, and there'd be some old master that lived there, and they'd go there. As a matter of fact, I know firsthand, Yogi Sensei and another guy, Miyashiro, they heard about this guy that taught this kata called Ufutunbo. And he was supposedly dying, and they went, Matayoshi commissioned them to go learn it. Mm. And they did, and they brought it back to the dojo, and they kind of customized it to the Matayoshi way of doing things, but that's where that kata came from. And I guess that was quite common. And a lot of the village katas have disappeared mm-hmm. because they did not get passed on. Mm-hmm. And a lot of it was family only.
Right.
And if the family stopped, or there wasn't a boy, or the boy wasn't interested, or whatever, mm-hmm. bye-bye. Mm-hmm. You know.
Looking for great entertainment? Want to find the best deals on food and drinks? Use the PubPal app to find great establishments near you. View daily specials, find live bands, karaoke, even poetry. If you're looking for something to do, PubPal is the answer, and it's only a click away. Download the app on the Apple Store and get the Android app on Google Play. And don't forget to like them on Facebook. Visit PubPalUSA.com to find out more. That's PubPalUSA. PubPalUSA.
Everyone loves the interview with Shuriru Chief Instructor Mike Awad from Episode 9, but no one can agree on which one of his stories is the best. So I picked my favorite to include in this show. The Kickboxer at the Dojo was a story I heard from my first teacher, Shion Joseph Walker, years before I ever moved to Cincinnati and met Sensei Awad. So it was a big deal for me to hear it straight from the source.
I got one more that I want to hear. Someone brought this up the other day. There was something about some guy with boxing gloves tried to come into the dojo and you knocked him out. What's the story on that? I want to get that right from the source.
This is a Friday night workout. I had all the ranks lined up. We're working out summertime. Well, right next to the dojo was this bar, the toughest bar up there. Guy was shot to death in there, called Our Place. We used to go there and drink and stuff and beat up the tough guys. We beat them all up. I mean, we rolled that bar and beat many of them. I don't know how many people we beat up. They'd come drunk over to our karate school and would come in. I said, "You're drunk. You got to come back when you're sober. You can't be here." They'd attack me and want to beat me up, and I'd knock them out, throw them out the door. And behind the school too. One time that's another story. But anyway, I was there one day, and it's Friday. We're working out. This guy comes in with these boxer wraps on and a jacket says kickboxing champion. And he's drunk as shit. And I said, "You can't talk to me now. I can't talk to you drunk. You gotta come back when you're sober. You've been drinking."
Doors were open.
Both the front doors wide open, summertime. I don't open them anymore.
That's why you keep them locked now.
Yes. They just can't wander in. And, hey, you gotta go this, that. Well, I'm kickboxing champion and so and so. Well, that's fine and stuff, but you gotta come back and you're sober, beat it. I got karate class to teach. I was just telling him to beat her, get out. Mm-hmm. I'll beat you up. So he left. And so he started class, and all the guys were there working out. So there was about 10 guys. And all of a sudden, he's out in front, milling around with a pencil going like this.
And I'm taking notes of watching.
Well, when I said, "What are you doing?" I'm writing down all your trophies. I said, "Get out of here! Just get out of here!" So he left. When the guest got drunker,
yeah.
Finally he come back and he come in. He said, "Ah!" So all the guys were this is true. I put them all in attention to watch us. So I went out there, and I hit him right in the jaw. Knocked him through the doors. Doors were open, but he hit the curb in the thing and busted the back of his head. It actually made me realize you just can't be pissed off and hit somebody as hard as you can, unless it's really. He wasn't that much of a threat, but he pissed me off.
He was laying on the sidewalk.
He pissed my ass off. Come to my dance class and shit. He picked the wrong time. I hit him too hard, man. He busted his head when he hit. So I got him up, and there's these people across the street waiting at the bus station, seeing all this. So I said, we had two of the students drag him in by his feet. This is true. They drug him in by his feet, closed the doors. And I used to have curtains there, and they pulled the curtains. And these people across the street seeing this. So I had the guys all lined up in attention. I had this about a 15, 16-year-old kid there whose dad owned a big car lot. Up the road, and apparently he never seen nothing like that. He got sick. He had to go throw up the toilet. And he's seen somebody knocked out.
Yeah.
Beat up.
Yeah.
And we drugged him in, and he was bleeding. So I had one student go get the paper towels, get some ice, and we got him up and I sat him on this bench, and I said, "Don't move." He just sat there.
He was conscious by this time.
Oh, he was conscious by now. I mean, if a person's like in the movies, they show him unconscious for 5 minutes, you got brain damage.
They're dead.
A person's knocked out, it's out for 30 seconds like that. He might be groggy and stuff. But if you're unconscious for 5 minutes, you got some kind of brain damage done. It ain't like the movies. Mm-hmm. But I got him up, and he was all groggy and stuff, and sat him there. And so I said, "Fuck, man, I got to do something. I'm gonna call the police because he don't sue me." And so I called the police and came in and said, "Look, this guy came in, he swung at me. We got all these guys here. I've seen him swing at me with this club. I threw a club there." "Well, yeah, I'm gonna protect my ass. I ain't gonna be some punk face. He seen him attack me with this. Okay, I understand. Do you want to press charges?" No, I just want you to know that this happened, and I don't want to press no charges. And he came in and attacked me with his club.
You just want it on record.
Yes, it's on the record. So he took him to the hospital because his head was, when he hit the curb, was split open in the back of that bed. And we had to brag on him and shit. So anyway, the cop took him. And that was like Friday. Well, Monday I was there at the dojo. And I was getting, you know, it was about 3:00 in the afternoon. And all of a sudden he comes in and walks into the office. That's when the front door used to be open. Mm-hmm. Now we are clustered. Cloistered. And he came in. I said, "I'm going to beat him up again." He bows to me. "Mr. Raymond, I'm sorry. I apologize for what I did. I was drunk out of my mind. And I apologize completely for what I did."
Wow.
Okay. He was working at the Moscow power plant. That was a plant that's up here.
Okay.
An energy plant, power plant. And they brought him in from somewhere. But anyway, he was drunk next door. And I apologize.
Wow.
True.
Humbled.
He had boxing wraps on his hands. Boxing? Who walks around with boxing wraps? Out drinking, you got boxing wraps on your hand?
Walk into a karate school and challenge somebody.
Yeah. He must have done that before at some bullshit school and they intimidated him, scared him. And
yeah.
He just got knocked, shit knocked out.
How do you drink with the boxing?
I have no idea. And he had a jacket on, one of them silk, you know,
yeah,
jackets on. Kickboxing champion. He had a kickboxing, never did shit. He came back, I apologize.
Thanks to everyone for supporting the show and all my guests in the first 6 months of Chop Talk. In the next 6 months, look forward to more interviews with martial artists from around the world. I'd like to go out with one final clip from Richard Awad, who reminds us to keep positive no matter how bad the situation is. We'll see you next week. Nihe Dibiru and Mate out.
Okay.
All right.
We're going to continue this again sometime here.
Absolutely.
If you see me before I go, wonderful. If not, enjoy life. Every day above ground is great.
Everyone, like the show? Enjoy hearing interviews with martial artists from around the world? Then share it with a friend, family member, co-worker, everyone at your dojo, your fellow karateka. You can find new episodes every Sunday at choptalk.podbean.com. That's choptalk.podbean.com. And don't forget to like the show on Facebook. Thanks.